to Influential Visions. My name is Tyler Cohen Wood. Here, we interview futuristic leaders to share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring that you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. And here's your host today, Nat Schooler.
Today, I've been joined by Pep Liar, and I'm not struggling with names, but there's an interesting pronunciation going on with that one. It's a tough one because there's two E's, and it was a tricky one. But so you're a former champion of optimization and experimentation turned business builder. You are the founder of CXL, Spiro, and Winter. So you're a busy guy. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Really appreciate it. So, yeah, I mean, you're involved with a lot of training for marketers and these kind of things. This series is all about kind of audience intelligence and really getting to grips with that, right? So, I know you have a big focus on testing messaging. So how does that fit with the audience intelligence kind of work that you do?
The audience intelligence. So before, let's say you start a new startup, in order to get product market fit with an audience that you're trying to sell to, something needs to happen before. And that something is message market fit. So basically you have to have messaging. What you say about yourself, your story, it needs to resonate with the intended audience. And so message testing fits in here because let's say you have a great story in your mind, in your head, and you might, you know, put some great copy on your website, but you don't really know how it lands on your audience. Like, does it hit the mark? Do they go, oh, yes. Exactly. Yes, that speaks to me. I'm that guy. Or are they like, meh, I don't care, you know? And so message testing is exactly that. It tells you how your messaging is resonating or not with your target audience.
Right. So do you spend time then actually listening to that audience first and what they talk about and the words that they use within their profiles and this kind of stuff in order to give you some sort of insights into like creating these messages?
Well, for sure. So a biggest source of learning, I think, is in sales meetings and not selling to your friends, but cold sales. Cold sales. So in order to really cut through and get somebody to pay attention, your messaging really needs to hit it home. Like it really needs to resonate. So, and obviously if you start a business or if you run a business, odds are that you have some domain expertise in whatever you're doing. You know, you kind of already know the market, the industry, the problem you're solving. So you come with some sort of a pre-existing knowledge about the audience that you're serving. And then doing cold sales, helps you learn more about it. If you're operating in an established category, you know, there are many people or companies doing what you're doing, then also what you can do very effective is review mining. So basically you go to, if you're B2B, you go to like G2, or, you know, if it's a consumer product, you might go to Amazon, and basically you read reviews of these competitive products, and you can see how do the people describe the pain they were in, and then what kind of emotional wording or, you know, what kind of vocabulary do you use to describe these services and products? You know, it's a very rich depository of audience insights.
I'm grinning away because I absolutely love that. I recommend people do the Amazon thing. Like if you're launching a book or, you know, you're launching anything, right? You can go and you can look at the book reviews and the insights that you get from people who are talking about the exact problem that you're going to solve and the words that they use, it hits home, right? Like it's one of the most powerful places because like they're actually telling you what they want, right? It's like
exactly. There is of course a caveat here because even if you do, you know, customer interviews, jobs to be done interviews, or you do this message mining from reviews or other places, you're learning about not your product, but you're learning mostly about the category that you're in. And so there's a big risk that if you just implement everything they're telling you, you're going to be just like everybody else in your category. So you're going to end up the same. So you're going to be look like a Me Too product, especially if it's a category with a strong category leader. You know, like in email marketing, if you end up like MailChimp, basically there's no reason to go with you because MailChimp is already exists, it's well known, it's trusted. So you learn as much as you can from the users and about the category, but you still need to, you know, bake in the differentiation, you know, your brand DNA, that needs to come from you, you know, your vision, that, you know, people won't tell you how you should be different.
Completely. Being different is so important. But so in terms of kind of using like audience intelligence or software mm-hmm. and stuff like that, like, I mean, I've been using Audience and I use mm-hmm. that to kind of understand people, understand my own audience and then audiences that resonate with a particular topic that I'm looking to get more coverage around, right? So then I reach out and I reach out to those people and kind of have a conversation. So you would obviously start with the Amazon, with the free stuff, and then maybe go to the audience intelligence kind of platforms and run a report there or what?
Let's clarify the question. So what am I trying to do here? What is the goal?
Well, you're moving into a category with a new product, a new business mm-hmm. that you're basically launching. You've worked out there's a need for that product, mm-hmm. And you're basically looking to communicate with the right audience around that product,
yeah.
with the right words that resonate mm-hmm. To those people.
Yeah, so you know, I mean, coming armed with your existing domain knowledge. You know, yeah, you do customer research through message mining, through reviews, or of course, interviews are most, let's say, insightful in terms of how much information you can get. They don't scale very well, so meaning it's costly and time-consuming to do the interviews. But, you know, doing at least 20, 30 interviews is definitely a must. So when I launched Winter, my messaging research tool, the very first thing was we basically designed some mock-ups of what the product might look like. So like non-functional design screens. And then on Twitter, basically, I was shouting, hey, who are people who are struggling with this problem? And the problem of, you know, you have a bunch of copy or words on your website and you don't really know what about it is good or bad. You know, like what hits home and what falls flat. And then I recruited some 20 people from various companies. And then I did jobs to be done interviews with them, essentially trying to understand how they solve the problem currently that I'm going to solve. And also to validate whether if I was to develop this solution, like, would that be of interest to them? You know, that you're validating demand. So those interviews were the most insightful for me in terms of preparation.
Yeah, very much so. That's extremely good advice when launching products to actually speak to potential customers, right, that have that problem. And they say, well, actually, I would buy that. I mean, you've got potential. You've got your new clients there already, yeah, or at least some kind of beta testers, right? So you can clearly work out from changing the words that someone is basically going to spend more money than they would ordinarily. If you get it wrong, like your whole launch could go completely wrong, right?
Well, totally. Also, you know, anything that you end up launching with is still a hypothesis. So we changed our positioning, even our name, 6 months after we launched. Because once there's, you know, before your product exists, people will tell you all kinds of things hypothetically. Oh, yes, I would buy it because blah, blah, blah. When it's like, okay, now cough up the money, things are different, you know, when it's,
yeah.
So you learn the most by actually bringing a product to the market and putting people in front of the, well, now, are you now going to buy? Is this what you really want? So that's when you're going to learn the most, obviously. So messaging. So the way I think of like your overall positioning and strategic narrative, and positioning, the way I define it is like, where does this product fit into your life? Like, what do you do with it? What's the use case? So that doesn't change very often, you know, like, but the messaging, how you communicate what your product is, that you should constantly be testing and iterating on, because A, the world changes a lot. And also you keep learning from the customers about, you know, let's say there are 10 benefits to buying a product. But out of those 10 benefits, you don't know which three are actually like the most important ones and which are kind of like, man, well, I don't really care about that. So that's a constant process of iterating and testing against your audience.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very insightful. I mean, I think, you know, when you're doing a survey in the beginning to launch, right, you're going to get all these questions come up. If you survey enough people, and they fill out your form, and you get, you know, say 30 people answering this question, 15 people answering that question, you know, as the most important problem that they have, then you know kind of which are the most important right in the beginning. But then moving forwards, it's going to change because your audience grows and it changes and the buyers change, right?
Totally. And the competitive landscape changes. So whatever that you are doing that is successful, other people are going to copy that. And so of course, if you are first to position yourself in the mind of the customer, you can be like, you know, let's say you can be the number one in the category, you know, in somebody's mind, maybe not actually, but so that can be an advantage. But you always need to be mindful of how others in your market are communicating, especially if you're not the category leader, and most are not. Most are, you know, challenger brands. So it's impossible for you to see your product the way your customers see your product. And, you know, we as entrepreneurs, we get so deep in, you know, we're too close that sometimes we stop seeing, and we forget what it's like to be new to our stuff. Hence, always, again, ask your customers, how do they perceive our messaging, our marketing, our sales pitch?
Fantastic. So where are you at the moment then with Winter?
We launched in May 2020. So we've been on the market for some 6 months, doing really well, like, you know, strong month over month growth, especially resonating with B2B SaaS and companies and agencies, marketing agencies. Super excited. We're solving a problem that has not been solved yet, which is the B2B buying cycle. So if you're selling to B2B buyers, you're selling marketing software of some sort, SEO software, you know, whatever, marketing automation, then what do the buyers think of your website copy, your sales pitch, you know, or even email copy? Testing before you broadcast that to the masses, or before you spend, you know, millions of dollars on your next ad campaign, you know, you test the messaging to find which ad messaging resonates the most with the audience, and, you know, double down on that.
Very useful. Very useful. I would think it would make a dramatic increase in return on investment, right, around that.
Totally. And also, like, think about most of B2B enterprise software is sold through sales, outbound sales. So it starts off with, you know, cold email, LinkedIn messaging, etc. And it's a numbers game. So typical response rates are something like, for every 1,000 emails you send, you get maybe 10 demos, you know. So it's like really, really, really terrible numbers. So imagine if your cold email would perform 25% better, it will be amazing growth. You know, if for every 1,000 emails, now instead of the average 10 demos, if you would get 15 demos, you know, something like this, it will be like massive, massive improvement. So, and again, most people, if, when they receive a cold email, they either respond or delete, mostly delete or ignore. They will not tell you, well, you know, what you're selling me, it doesn't resonate because XYZ and your email is boring because blah, blah, blah. They don't take the time to tell you why your email sucks. You know, hence, again, you know, with Winter, if you sell to VP Marketings, we put your cold email in front of those people and they will tell you how it sucks or what about it is good.
Very useful. I mean, if you close, you know, one more sale, right, from a cold email campaign,
yeah,
every time, like it could represent, like, I don't know, if some of this software is very expensive, right? So
totally,
lifetime return on investment.
Typical, let's say mid-market software is already starts from like 20K a year. And this is like the bottom prices. If you look at the enterprise software companies that have gone public where they, you know, disclose a lot of information, then you can see that, you know, 70 to 80% of revenue comes from deals that are worth more than 100,000 a year. You know,
yeah,
customers are paying more than 100,000 a year. So one customer is worth a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. And then if they keep that customer because they have the right messaging when they communicate with that customer. So it's a continual life cycle, right, of reinvention of the words to match their expectations, yeah?
Totally. I mean, I don't think messaging plays much role in retention. It's the actual product needs to deliver and the service and all these other related things. But if you look at typical retention rates for software, then in enterprise, it's like 99% a year retention rates. It's just this standard. It's because it's very sticky because of like switching costs and all kind of other things. Obviously, it's easier to switch for lower cost products, but even in mid market software products, the annual retention rates, the standard is very, very high.
Yeah, it's a very exciting time for you then right now.
Oh, well, I mean, I'm building a business. That's always an exciting time, you know. So I have, as you initially said, so I run three businesses, or like I'm on the board of one of them now, Spiro, our agency, which was the first one I started. I mean, I had a failed SaaS back in the day as well, but now running the e-learning business and Winter, the SaaS business, I mean, which are in different stages. It's the more you grow, the more exciting it gets for me personally. I mean, it's never a dull day as an entrepreneur.
Very much so. Very much so. So what does your average day look like then?
Since I am in the, you know, senior leadership, a lot of the things that I achieve is through other people. So I spend a fair amount of time in meetings. I would like to think that too much time in meetings, but then also like these days I do much less hands-on implementation work myself. With Winter, I do it more because Winter is still early stages. Basically it's just getting started here. And I do a lot of support myself to see what kind of questions people ask, like doing this audience research. I find live support to be a live chat to be a tremendous resource for this. I do a lot of sales. I do all the demos myself, again, learning from the audience. What kind of objections do they bring up? What kind of questions do they ask? What else do they want my product to do? You know, always learning. Of course, it's not sustainable in the long run that the CEO does all of these things, so the product team eventually should take over. But right now, I mean, in the early stages of a company, you know, when I'm setting the direction of the company, I think it's important that I'm very closely in touch. It's not some junior support person somewhere, you know, and I'm missing out on the market feedback. And so I'll do a lot of meetings, and I, between the two companies that I actively run, I'm going to split my week where Monday I'm with CXL, Tuesday I do Winter stuff, and so on, you know, like I I tried to do like half and half, like 4 hours and 4 hours, but like the context switching is just too hard.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of research around that, isn't there? So you can, if you get interrupted from being in one task, and you switch to something else, like I think there's some ridiculous figure that you make a massive loss in productivity. I think it's like 50% or something. It's huge.
Totally. And that I also do split my weekdays into meeting days and deep work days. So certain days of the week, I don't schedule any meetings. It's just blocked for deep work. Because again, if you have a meeting or a podcast in the middle of the day, it disrupts your deep work where you really need to think. It's like right now for winter, I'm working on our strategic narrative, preparing some sales decks for my sales team, things like that. They require a lot of thought, thinking, also research. So meetings really disrupt. And then today is my meetings day. So I have back-to-back meetings. I'm exhausted by the end of today, but then, you know, I have more time for deep work tomorrow.
Right. That's a good idea. I mean, I've got a friend who runs a hosting business. He runs a hosting business in Denmark. And he suggests that you build. When you hit the ground on a Monday, you work really hard. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, really hard. And then you kind of go up, and then you slow down for the weekend. That's the kind of way that he does things. And I'm trying to work into that because I think there's a lot of research around like 55 hours a week. If you work more than that, then you're doing something wrong, like because productivity just drops.
Well, I work just 40 hours a week because I have children, small kids, and I also want to be a father. And, you know, we human beings, we're children only for a minute. Most of our lives, we're adults. And so my kids are babies just for a minute. You know, they're 6 and 9. So I'm every day home very early. Actually, I'm starting my day at 6 a.m. So I'm home by 2 p.m. already, or like I finish work at 2 p.m.
Super.
So I can spend time with my family. So also, I think this forces productivity because I can't like just, you know, screw around at the office all day long. I have to like be on it. So I'm always looking for leverage and trying to work on things that have the most impact.
Very much so. It's about knowing where to spend your time, right? And just hitting the things that are going to make the biggest impact on your business, yeah?
For sure. And also, you really need to learn to do things through other people. So the only way you can scale yourself is by delegating all the stuff that you need to get done that other people will get it done for you. This year, I read one of these books that really changed my paradigm on this. It's called Who Not How. So when you start a new project, a new task, instead of asking how to get it done, you ask who can get this done for me. You know, and yeah, so I highly recommend the book, and it dramatically increased my productivity because now I'm like what is the 10% that only I can do? 90% of things that I'm doing, also other people can do, and maybe even better than I, you know? And so that's, again, leverage.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I mean, I was talking to Michael Tobin about this, and he was saying that, you know, he'll delegate something, so then it's off his list, right? And then they need to come back to him and say, well, it's done or it isn't done. And then he'll either put it on the list again, or he'll forget about it. And that kind of resonated with me. I quite like that approach. It's, you know, I mean, I think the more businesses that you run, the more projects you're involved with, the bigger complications that you have, right?
I mean, you need to trust the people around you. And also when delegating, you don't delegate the how, sorry. When you're delegating something, you don't manage the how to get it done, only what needs to get done. What does the final outcome look like? You know, what do you need to get done? And then they should figure out the how. It's also more empowering for the people that get the task, that they have, you know, autonomy and independence on deciding what's the best way to go about it. And, you know, like, look at Elon Musk, you know, obviously his family life is suffering, you know, he's on his, you know, seventh wife, and I don't know if his kids ever see him, he sleeps at the office. But like, the guy is a productivity maniac, how many excellent companies he runs, right? And I'm sure it's by hiring very good people around him. Obviously, they cost a fortune, but he can afford it right now. And then he is delegating a lot, right? Like, he's bringing ideas, he's discussing, but he's, how much of hands-on work is he doing? Probably very little, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So what would be your most important task that you have to do on a Monday when you go into the office?
Well, there's certain things that the CEO does not delegate, and the most important thing is the vision. Like, what are we actually, building towards? What is it that we're trying to do? So that's number one thing. So communicating vision, making sure that there's alignment in the team, and then also creating strategy. Strategy around how to achieve our task. What is most important? What are the priorities? Overseeing the strategy and implementing strategy. Of course, the whole company works on that. And you can have your, if you have an head of operations type of person at your company, somebody can oversee the execution of said strategy. But strategy creation is 100% CEO's role. And CEO should also, of course, do any type of recruitment for senior roles, So I'm doing a lot of, hiring for key roles is all on me, Obviously, I'm always trying to hire people that are smarter than me in those areas that they're going to be in charge of, Because again, if I am achieving my goals through other people, I need these people to be as good as I can afford. You know, with a small business, obviously that's also a trade-off where you cannot be like Netflix or Netflix is famous for hiring the 10x people and paying them 10x salaries. So, but not everybody can pay 500k a year to executives, So small businesses, you have to do more, compensate with vision, with like, what are we doing here? Why does this matter? Because ultimately, we're all going to die. And it would really suck if we spent our precious years on this planet doing some pointless thing,
Completely. So when it comes to like audience intelligence, What's the most important thing then when you're using some software to find out about a potential audience? Like, what's the most important kind of insights that you're going to get from that?
When you do messaging testing, or?
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about messaging, that's one thing I wanted to explore with you before you shoot off. We're talking both private messaging and public messaging, right? So we're talking email messaging, and we're also talking website messaging and public messaging.
Most important thing is to identify friction. So what are the things that are really missing the mark, falling flat, or even turning people off? And I see that a lot. And another big source of friction is not like people are going to hate on you, but what you communicate on your website or other mediums is just boring, And if it's boring, A, they're not going to read it. They're just going to quickly skim in their mind. They're going to label it as blah, whatever. And, they're not going to spend their time on it. So need to optimize for, obviously cognitive fluency here, that it's easy to understand, easy to label you, but also interestingness. Does this, do you pause and actually read it, or are you just, glancing over it? So a lot of the data that I see with Winter is that most of the messaging that companies are putting out there falls in the meh category. You know, it's not offensive, but it's like, I've seen this everywhere. You know, like if I'm email marketing software and I say, well, you can send beautiful email newsletters, I'm like, you know, like like who is turned on by that messaging? Like nobody. It's like, yeah, obviously every email marketing software enables me to send newsletters. Tell me something new and interesting, you know?
Right.
And so knowing what are the parts of your messaging, your copy that are either outright offensive or just really boring, you know, once you know what those are, now you can improve on it. You know, it's the old adage of, you know, what you can only improve what you measure. So same goes for your content, for my marketing messaging. If you know what sucks, you can make it better. Right. So I think that is most important when it comes to doing messaging research for, you know, or audience research on messaging.
Right. So then basically that's creating like a massive friction, yeah, because you know, it needs to be smooth, right? Like people want to go to the site and they want to read down the page. Well, you want them to read down the page, right? So then it goes to like persona-based messaging, yeah? So you're basically looking at what demographics your buyer is, right? Because there are multiple people involved with purchasing software as a service products, yeah? So,
the more expensive it is, then more people are involved. Yeah.
Yeah. So then you have some people who are really technical. You have some people who just don't really care. Like they're like, well, just go and buy it. Like if it does what I want it to do, like, I'm not interested. Like you just go and look at it and they get someone else to look at it. So it's like creating something and working out what's the most important bits of that on the page, right? Or in that message, yeah?
Exactly right.
Yeah. And so then obviously you're gonna work that to a finer detail and you're gonna segment that, right? So if you're doing direct messaging, you're gonna segment that audience into.
Well, yeah, the persona-based stuff is very difficult because also, I mean, for expensive, let's say enterprise software, this is done in person. So this is done in sales, you know, like because you have multiple meetings and et cetera, et cetera. Now on the website, doing personalized messaging is much harder. And also when you're doing marketing, there's some pretty compelling evidence out there that actually non-personalized messaging does better than personalized. I had this very experience many years ago when doing a conversion optimization project for a big Fortune 500 company called Iron Mountain. And so they used very fancy, expensive technology to personalize completely the website based on your IP address. So they were detecting if you're a small business, you saw the small business version. If you're government, you saw another one. If you're military, you saw another one, and et cetera. I think like 12 different versions of the website. And so we just, out of curiosity, ran an A-B test and tested each segment against the non-personalized version. And it won in every single category, which was interesting. And so if we look at marketing and growing your basically market penetration, there's also compelling evidence out there that in most products that you sell, you know, let's say Coca-Cola, most people that are buying your product are infrequent buyers. Which means that most of the money that Coca-Cola company makes comes from people who are buying one Coke a year. So if you are only advertising to your core audience, your core buyer, like somebody who's drinking 10 cans a day, you know, you're never going to grow because you need to expand your market penetration And so advertising broad with a broad messaging is the way to go to basically to grow outside of your existing base. So personalizing messaging on the website is hard to do. The way that I see, the way that is most consistent to work in is self-segmenting on the website. So basically on the website, there's a way where people can choose, I am this, I am this, I am this. And then they go down a particular funnel. So for instance, right now, really popular hot weight loss product is Noom, N-O-O-M. They're spending like $1 billion on ads. And so if you click on one of their ads, you will come up on a landing page, which will ask you, do you want to lose weight or get more fit or, you know, maybe some other options. And based on your choices, you know, the funnel is different, you know.
Right.
Maybe a lot of it is the same also, but there's some differences here. They start to speak to you based on your, you know, goal and et cetera, et cetera. So that sort of segmentation in terms of messaging works well. But if you're trying to like automate it and so on, it's tricky. It's there's no one good way to go about it.
Very interesting. I was thinking about this very thing the other day, so I thought I'd just ask you. And that's very interesting. Thank you. I appreciate that a lot. And it's been really, really interesting. So if people want to find Winter, they need to go to wynter.io and they can check it out, right?
That's right. Yeah. And I'm very active on Twitter and LinkedIn. So just, you know, connect with me there and yeah.
Super. Well, I'll drop some links underneath the show notes. Thank you, Pep. It's much appreciated.
Thanks for listening. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review.